Well, that was very special. What a great privilege it is to have, or a blessing it is to have an a cappella youth choir. Something I don't think any other congregation I know of has. Appreciate Mr. Scruggs and all his work and all the young men and ladies who make it possible. We will have adult choir practice, by the way, next week after Bible study, between Bible study and church. I'm going to begin this sermon by reading an announcement from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. It was put out earlier this week. The Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife has canceled 5 days of razor clam digging that was planned at Twin Harbors and Long Beach due to elevated marine toxin levels. Shellfish managers still hope to move forward with 3 days of digging at 4 Washington Ocean beaches, pending the results of further testing for domoic acid poisoning. Domoic acid is a natural toxin produced by certain types of algae and can be harmful or even fatal if consumed in sufficient quantities. Neither Long Beach nor Twin Harbors have met state public health standards for toxins. The directors say we're optimistic we'll be able to open the beaches in a few days. Their target date was November 17th. So for those of you who will be interested in digging for clams, you are going to be disappointed this week. From the Seafood Health Facts website, some species of naturally occurring marine algae, phytoplankton, have the ability to produce toxins that can cause consumer illness. These toxins accumulate in fish and shellfish that feed on the algae. Humans can ingest these naturally occurring toxins by eating shellfish like clams, oysters, and mussels, or crustaceans like crabs and lobsters. And it says this can cause certain types of reactions. Got another place here where it lists one of them I think you might be interested in. Paralytic shellfish poisoning, PSP. It's an illness that may have serious and potentially fatal effects. It's caused by eating bivalve shellfish and other molluscan shellfish that have been contaminated by toxins produced, certain microscopic marine algae found in coastal waters. Symptoms are a tingling or sensation of numbness around the lips that gradually spreads to the face and neck, a prickly sensation in the fingers and toes, drowsiness, headache, dizziness, difficulty swallowing, incoherent speech, prickly sensations in the arms and legs, weakness, rapid pulse, and in some cases temporary blindness, nausea, and vomiting. All things, of course, that we all want to have. Kind of reminds you of the advertisements for drugs on television. You know, take this for your blood pressure. However, you know, the side effects include, you know, things like heart attacks, death, Alzheimer's, on. You think, well, really, that's what I want? So I'm going to take this drug. Bivalves are animals that live in the ocean on the floor. And the reason they are called bivalves is because they have two valves, an intake and an exhale valve. They intake water, and then they filter it. They have a filtering system in their body that God designed because they are the cleanup crew. They are the cleanup crew that cleans up the water in the ocean. And as the water circulates through the bivalves, they collect little tidbits of things that are in the ocean, and the water that they put out is therefore cleaner. It says bivalve molluscan shellfish, like clams and oysters, obtain food by pumping water through their system and filtering out small organisms. If large numbers of toxic algae are present in the water, then the shellfish accumulate high levels of toxins. One example of a toxin-producing algae is the red tide, which produces a toxin that can cause paralytic shellfish poisoning. Of course, they go on to talk about the various state agencies that monitor the bivalves and monitor the various types of shellfish and warn people when they are not fit to eat. I thought it might be worthwhile today to examine why God has laws about clean and unclean foods, not just the very obvious we shouldn't be eating animals that are full of toxins, but on a spiritual level, why we are to learn to shun what is unclean and to fill our body and our mind only with those things that are clean and approved by God. Babies eat everything. Babies like to jam things in their mouth regardless of, it seems, any abandon or any caution. I have one granddaughter that leaves bits of paper are tasty and should be eaten. And several times a day we have to go over and feel around her mouth with our dirty fingers and try to fish out this piece of paper she's choking on. And of course there are other things that babies eat or children put in their mouths. My daughter Holly, who is an emergency room doctor, called me in a panic. Well, sounded like a panic. She had another baby came into her ER up in Puyallup after having eaten one of those little square packets of dishwasher soap. Because, you know, they put, that's the number one poisoning of children in America now, are the little packets. I went and looked in my cabinet, and guess what? They're pink and red and green. They look like candy, and they're not much bigger than some pieces of candy. And in some cases, they've caused complete liver failure, and the baby has to have a liver transplant, which is a horrific experience for the rest of their life. So then she tells me, you know, that be sure and lock them up or make sure that cabinet has child locks on it. But that's just one example, that babies eat everything that looks good to them. And unfortunately, humans ingest into their mind a lot of unclean things that are also very harmful. Parents have to constantly monitor and watch what their children are eating. We as Christians have to constantly watch and monitor ourselves as to what's going into our mind. Food is fuel. If you consider the sort of large plate full of food that we eat each day and how it powers our body, we get energy, we're able to use our brains, we're able to use our muscles, we're able to walk, run, jump, we're able to stay awake for, depending on the person, of course, 16 to 18 hours a day. Our body is very efficient at gaining what we need from the food that we eat. But we have to have proper fuel, and our Creator created certain things to be eaten and certain things not to be eaten. God designed all flesh. All flesh is not the same. God designed protein, amino acids. He invented stomachs, designed stomachs and digestive processes that are different. The digestive process of a chicken, of course, having raised chickens, you know that chickens eat anything and everything. They will eat seemingly what, you know, they'll turn garbage, your household garbage, into the world's best fertilizer in 24 hours. Chickens, to me, are an amazing animal. They're certainly an amazing blessing from God. But they have a gizzard. And if you've ever butchered chickens and torn apart gizzards, you understand that they have this little box of rocks, little muscular box of rocks in their stomach or in their body that grinds up the food they eat. And they are able to handle bacteria. They're able to handle foods that come into their system that we simply are not able to. Some animals have, as you know, a four-chambered stomach, what they call the ruminants, cows, deer, sheep, a number of others. And they have a stomach that not only kills all the seeds and cooks, provides heat, but then goes through several layers of digestion so that they are able to live on plain grass. Humans could not live on plain grass. In fact, most animals on the earth could live on just plain grass or thrive on it. But ruminants are able to. They have a very interesting system because it also produces heat. And that's why they have to do what's called chew the cud. When I lived in Alaska, people would wonder how could those herds of caribou run around on the Arctic Circle when it's 80 below zero all winter and seemingly just as comfortable as possible. Well, the answer is caribou have the largest pound or largest stomach per pound of weight of any animal on the face of the earth. And having dressed out a dozen of them, I can tell you that it is massive and it grows very quickly if you put it out in the sun. They have to constantly be expelling the gases that are produced. When we were in Alaska, we'd signed up to salvage moose. And so moose that were hit on the highways in the winter, the church signed up with the local food bank, which would register with the state patrol. And so I would get a call three or four times a year, normally about 1 or 2 in the morning when it was 30 below zero. And I would then call normally Marty Van Boxel or a couple other guys in the church there that didn't work in the winter because they were fishermen, worked in the summer. And we would go out late at night with a pickup truck and several guys with knives and saws, and we would salvage a moose that was by the side of the highway. And it's amazing, even after being dead for an hour or perhaps a little less, how warm and toasty the inside of those moose were when it was 25 or 30 below outside. And, of course, the guys in Alaska were fast. We would get one of those moose cut up and quartered in the back of my truck in 20, 30 minutes. And a couple of years there, we salvaged moose before the feast, and then we used the moose meat at the family day. And I always wanted to announce at the feast we're going to have roadkill moose for the banquet for family day, and my wife would never allow me to say that. She told me she would divorce me. She's going to sit in the front row and throw rocks. But most of the moose that we salvaged were actually had hit a semi or a car with their head and had a broken neck and really had been bled out, you know, pretty well. They were actually fairly well killed. But that's not the purpose of the sermon today. I didn't want to tell you all about roadkill moose. But the point is that God designed these animals to have an internal combustion engine that produces heat. And that heat then circulates in their blood supply throughout their body, and they can survive just fine when it's very, very cold outside, as long as they have adequate food to eat. Now, God created also plants, but you know, we don't eat all plants, do we? There are certain plants we simply don't eat. I want to begin today in Leviticus chapter 20, because as God created many animals that we don't eat, he also created many plants that we don't eat. And I know that there are some people, probably some in this room, that are experts or very well versed in what kind of mushrooms are edible and what kind are not. Now, this past couple weeks, we've had about five different kinds of mushrooms growing out in our stand of trees, and there's just all sorts of them, great big brown ones, little white ones, they're just a big variety, and I don't know enough about them to know which ones would be edible, which ones would not. I know there are websites that show pictures, but I'm just not brave enough to go out there and start digging them up and putting them in the fry pan unless I really know. Because I know that some plants are good to eat. I know that some wild plants, wild mushrooms, are toxic and could be very, very dangerous. There's a purpose why God created things you should eat and things you should not eat. Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 24. God says, I have said to you that you shall inherit the land, or their land, and I will give it to you to possess, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God who has separated you from the people. So God says we are to be separate. He said he has separated Israel from the other peoples of the Middle East. You shall therefore distinguish between clean animals and unclean. So the purpose of it was because you have been separated between unclean birds and clean. You shall not make yourselves abominable by beast or by bird or by any kind of living thing that creeps on the ground, which I have separated from you as unclean, and you shall be holy to me. For I, the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from the peoples, so you shall be mine. So the purpose of uncleanness, unclean animals, as it mentions here, was that Israel would learn they were to be separate, that they were to be a clean people. Just as Peter later says, we are a holy people, a chosen generation. Those same principles apply to us today. Let's go over now to Leviticus chapter 11, where the laws of, or one list of clean and unclean animals is mentioned. This is probably the most comprehensive list. The one on Deuteronomy 14 is a little more condensed and shorter. But here God is telling them not to be like the pagans, that they were to be separate, that they were not to be eating of the things that the others around them did. God knew there would be toxins, there would be dangers in eating those animals, and also he wanted the people of Israel to choose what is clean only for their minds. Now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the animals which you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Now there follows three categories of animals. Everyone know what those are? Pretty easy. You have land animals, you have water animals, and you have air animals. So land animals, fish, and then those that dwell in the air, the birds. So these categories are given here, and the distinguishing characteristics of those that are clean to eat and those that are not. The first is the animals that chew, that divide the hoof, having cloven hooves, and chew the cud that you may eat. And he mentions here a list of those that are not that way. You shall not eat those that have cloven hooves, but you don't have cloven hooves, like the camel. Or it says the rock hyrax, or the, mentions here the hare, the bunny rabbit. And verse 7, the swine, although it divides the hoof, having cloven hooves, yet does not chew the cud. In fact, pigs or swine have an internal organ system, a digestive system, almost identical to people. They're very, very similar when you open them up. Unfortunately, it looks a lot like ours. So we do not have a system that is able to take care of all of his impurities, and neither do the swine. It's interesting that pork is the number one meat eaten in the earth. There's more pork eaten than any other type, such as beef or fish or perhaps other categories. But it is a very common meat. God says it is not to be eaten, and there, of course, are health reasons for that. We're all familiar with trichinosis. So as their flesh you shall not eat, their carcasses you shall not touch. So we were to wash after touching their carcasses. He's talking about if they find them dead, whatever. And, of course, the various types of bacteria that can be on them can grow very quickly. These you may eat of all that are in the water, whatever has fins and scales. And so fish swim. They have fins and scales. They don't just sit on the bottom and filter water. They don't crawl along the bottom. They swim up in the water, and they have fins and scales. But all in the seas or in the rivers that do not have fins and scales, all that move in the water or any living thing which is in the water are an abomination to you. They shall be an abomination. You shall not eat their flesh. You shall regard their carcasses as an abomination. Next, it goes down to the birds. These you shall regard as abomination among the birds. Now, Burns, he doesn't tell us what are the characteristics. Instead, we look at these animals and their behavior and also the configuration of their feet, and we're able to draw pretty strong conclusions about which birds are clean and okay to eat and which ones are not. The first, of course, would be the carrion-eating birds, eagles, buzzards, falcons, ravens, those that would eat other animals or dead animals are certainly unclean. The hawk, the fisher, a little bit farther on down, the stork, the heron, those very, very long-legged animals that live out in the water. And he mentions also the bat, the heron. I can't imagine anybody eating a bat, but I guess somebody would. All flying insects that creep on all fours shall be an abomination to you. So flying insects, we're not. The only insect that is clean to eat in God's list here is the locust, verse 22. You may eat the locust. It's got hind legs that go above its torso, and it flies, and it eats only the grass or the green leaves that it comes upon. So we have in Leviticus chapter 11 here a pretty comprehensive list of animals. Verse 27, whatever goes on all its paws among all kinds of animals that go on all fours, these are unclean to you. So it mentions, of course, all those animals that are not ruminants. And there's a long list here of the lizard, the reptile, the chameleon, basically these skin animals that are, as you would call them, primarily reptiles. So here we have a list of things that are unclean and we should not be eating. Why is that? Well, it's because they're not good for us is the first thing. And secondly, of course, it's because we are to learn some very important lessons for that. Now, over the years, the Church of God has produced quite a number of articles, a pretty good library of material about why we don't eat unclean foods. Just to give you kind of a little highlight from one of them in the past here, it mentions here that the Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14 are the primary passages in the Bible that discuss this subject, and they are, of course, the rule of thumb. Modern science is just learning more and is revealing how practical and important these laws are. For many, many years, we had booklets on seven laws of radiant health. We probably had occasional sermons and messages on good diet, exercise, the importance of staying healthy because our temple, our body is the temple of God's Spirit. Perhaps in recent years we haven't spoken on that subject as much as we should have. We've neglected it because we had other things in mind, rather important issues. But we ought to be reminded from time to time that God is concerned about our health and is concerned about letting us have the best experience we can physically while we are here on the earth, and that we are to glorify God in all that we do with our bodies. He mentions here that Leviticus 11 is a ruminant animal he's talking about. If you've ever been to Africa, the number of ruminant animals is absolutely astounding. I've only spent 3 weeks in Africa, but as we drove around and flew around, the number of antelopes and types of gazelles and buffaloes and the various types of animals in massive numbers, literally millions of wildebeests and gazelles and impalas and other animals in Africa, it's just an amazing number of clean animals to eat that are on that continent. And of course, America I think the buffalo numbered about 30 million when the settlers got here. And now, of course, they're down to a much, much smaller number than that. But God did provide huge numbers of clean animals for us to eat. Vast areas of the globe are covered by rangelands, what we call savannas or pampas grass. These are marginal lands that don't grow crops well, but grazing animals thrive and do very well on them. That grass can then be turned into high-protein meat and good and milk and other good products for us. God created animals. Each one has a purpose. The carnivores, the beasts of prey, play a role in controlling populations and in keeping the balance of nature in line. The pig or swine is specifically mentioned as being unclean, not permitted as human food. And some, of course, try to come up with reasons arguing around that. Other writers find numerous logical reasons relating to the ecology or economics. And I know when years and years ago, when my wife's family were first visited by ministers in the church, and Patty was only about 15, and they were raising pigs. In fact, she had her own pigs. And so that's one thing that we haven't done since we got married is raise any pigs. But at any rate, the minister said, well, you know, those are unclean. And her stepmom said, no, they're clean. We feed them only clean food. And so humans reason, well, it must be, you know, something around what God said. But, of course, they eventually came to see that and took all the pigs down to the sale barn and got rid of them. It says, as non-ruminants with digestive tracts similar to that of humans, pigs are unable to survive on grasses and thus essentially are ecological competitors with humans. They like to eat the same food. But the problem is that we shouldn't be eating worms. And one of the major diseases transmitted by swine and other unclean animals is called trichinosis. It's caused by a small parasitic roundworm that gets into the muscle tissue of animals and humans. Currently, 1% of the world is infected with trichinosis worms, over 70 million people. This is not surprising that people in the world eat more pork than any other kinds of meat. The average American consumes approximately 60 pounds per person each year. And, of course, it is a challenge to avoid. You know, pepperoni, lots of pizza things, lots of lard being used in pie dough and other places. And a couple times my wife and I have both gone to Trader Joe's and found these big, you know, chicken sausage or chicken jalapeno sausage. You get home and in a very small word it says, in pure pork casing. So then you end up getting your fillet knife out and filleting all the insides and throwing away the pure pork casing. But it's very, very difficult to avoid all of the various places where they put it, but God tells us we are to, and we are to learn lessons from that. The larva of a pork parasite, once inside the human intestine, can migrate through the tissues to the heart, eyes, and brain, and eventually cause death. And, of course, that's not something any one of us want to experience. Biblically clean fish are free swimmers in bodies of water. Most unclean are bottom dwellers, or they simply drift around in the water and clean up the contents of the ocean. Also mentions crabs here are professional garbage hunters, as scavengers that eat almost anything. So I have a little bit of experience catching crabs, not in recent years, but we lived for a number of years in Savannah, Georgia, where my father was, of course, flying B-47 bombers over to destroy Russia all the time. But the blue crabs would come in big numbers to the Savannah River and the bays there. And we would buy a package of chicken necks and leave them out for a couple days in the sun so they got really good and rotted, and then tie them on a string, throw them out in the water or off of a pier, and then you'd pull them in real slow, about every 15 minutes, and there would normally be a blue crab on there eating, and somebody else had a big net on a pole, and you'd try to get him. And we sometimes got quite a few, and then the rule of blue crabs, this is something you've never known before probably, you have to boil them alive. If they die before you get them home, you can't eat them because within 2 minutes they're already developing all sorts of toxic bacteria and people got sick from eating them. So we had to bring them home in buckets of water, and then my mom would chase them with big tongs and then hold them in the boiling water till they died. It's kind of gross, but then they would make popping noises. But a few times they got loose and chased us across the kitchen with their pinchers, which I remember being 6 and 7 years old, that was quite the experience, watching my mom chase this screaming crab all across the kitchen floor. So God did not intend that to be eaten by us. Mentions here, undercooked crabs, crayfish, and snails carry significant amounts of parasitic infections. And, of course, that's very true. The final group, of course, birds to bugs. Birds of prey, we already mentioned, are not clean to eat. And God's dietary laws, of course, are very clear as to what we should and should not ingest into our system. In Deuteronomy chapter 14, let's go over, that's the short version of Leviticus chapter 11 and the last half of Deuteronomy 14 you are very familiar with because it's about the Feast of Tabernacles. But God wants us to be a separate people. We are not to be like the world around us. We are to come out of her, my people. We are not to be a part of society and the evil things that are done in it. We are to be a light to the world and to be separate from the untoward generation that we live in. We look for a new heavens and a new earth and a better system, a better time on the earth while we are respectful and while we are very productive in this life. Deuteronomy chapter 14 and verse 1, you are the children of the Lord your God. And so you shall not cut yourselves nor shave the front of your head for the dead. So they did some things for the dead in a way of mourning or in a way of showing honor to them or something that God said not to do. We were not to disfigure our bodies in any way in order to honor the dead or other things. You are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all peoples who are on the face of the earth. So Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So these principles have not been altered or changed. You shall not eat any detestable thing. Notice you shall not eat any detestable thing. God does not make allowances for once in a while or something that's partially detestable. He lists again the animals which you may eat, the ox, the sheep, the goat, deer, gazelle. These are all the ruminant animals, antelope, sheep. There are, of course, many, many varieties of them. Then he mentions all courses, same thing, verse 7, those that have chewed the cud but simply do not have the right formation on their hooves. And that would include, by the way, llamas. Some people have asked about llamas. They have a cloven hoof a non-cloven hoof like a camel. They do not have a cloven hoof like a cow. He mentions the swine, and then finally about the fish and about the birds. So we have, again, God gives it to us a second time. So that we are not, we're not getting around it somehow. But it is really true. It is one of those things that God wants us to be, which is separate and not allowing ourselves to be used physically to honor some other God. Let's go here just on a sidelight, but it's a very important one, Leviticus chapter 19. Leviticus chapter 19 is a chapter about being holy to God. Leviticus 19 is quoted by Jesus Christ three times in the Sermon on the Mount. It mentions about loving your neighbor as yourself, as the second great commandment is in this chapter. Leviticus 19 and verse 2, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now, the first two ways to be holy are, number one, to honor your father and mother. Because apparently that is not done as it should be in many pagan societies. And also to keep my Sabbaths, verse 3. For I am the Lord your God. Do not turn to idols nor make for yourselves molded gods, for I am the Lord. And he mentions here sacrifices, and he mentions some of the things that they should be doing in the right way. He mentions not, verse 13, not cheating your neighbor or robbing. Verse 17, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. Jesus Christ quoted that at least parenthetically or in a paraphrase way when he says, if you even hate your brother, you are guilty then of murder. On down a little bit farther is verse 28, which has been misquoted for many, many years. It says, you shall not make any cuttings in your flesh for the dead, nor tattoo any marks on you or make any markings on you. These are two separate statements. It is in one verse, so some modern paraphrases translated as you shall not make any cuttings or tattoo any marks on your flesh for the dead. That's simply wrong. These are separate statements, just as commandment number one and commandment number two would be considered as separate statements. Since both statements are in our modern verse 28, some have assumed they are the same sentence. And of course, that's not the case. If that were the case, you could follow that on to the next verse and say it's okay to give your daughters to harlotry as long as it is not done to honor the dead. The Hebrew words for nor tattoo any marks on you according to Strong's Concordance, simply say, never make or print any marks on you, and that is a separate statement. For you shall not shave around the sides of your head, nor disfigure yourselves or make cuttings in your flesh for the dead. Quite a number of reputable Bible commentaries bear this out. Kyle and Deitch commentary on the Old Testament, very, very large. I think it's about 25 volumes, written by, I think, some Germans. Basically say these are two separate statements. They are both stand alone. And it simply says, correctly, you shall not make any cuttings in your flesh for the dead, number one. Number two, you shall not make any tattoos or any marks on your body. And, of course, this is in keeping with Leviticus 19, which simply is about how we honor God. A couple others you might know, and I've had some correspondence with some other ministers about this that certainly is very important. The JFB commentary understands the two phrases as being separate. They simply had the two statements, you shall not make any cuttings in your flesh for the dead, number one. Number two, you shall not print or make any tattoos or marks upon you. And the Hebrew word is a parallel to the Greek word, I guess, tatoris, which simply is a word we use for tattoos. And you see them everywhere now because we live in a nation that is going so far away from just drifting from God. The Believer's Bible Commentary says the same thing. Dake's Annotated Reference Bible also says tattooing was practiced in various pagan nations from the earliest times, as well as markings with all kinds of paint and cuttings in the flesh. These were connected with superstition, and any disfigurement of the body was an outrage to God and an insult to him who designed the body originally. So the scholarship is, I think, pretty clear. There's another verse we're going to look at that has also been misused in trying to make this doctrine something different, God's teaching something different than it actually is. And I want to look at a couple New Testament verses that people misquote and misuse, trying to say it is okay to eat unclean foods. Let's go first to Matthew chapter 8. And this I have heard used as proof that when the swine went down the hill into the water, that made all pigs good to eat. Never have quite figured that out. But anyway, that, you know, when you're looking for a reason to justify what you want to do, there is no limit to human arguments. Matthew chapter 8 and verse 28, when he had come to the other side, so they had gotten in a boat and gone across the Sea of Galilee to the country of the Gergesenes, there met him two demon-possessed men, coming out of the tombs exceedingly fierce, so no one could pass that way. So we have these men who were demon-possessed living in caves, and as people walked by, they attacked them. Suddenly they cried out, saying, what have we to do with you, Jesus, you Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? So they know, the demons know, the spirit world knows that there is a time of punishment coming for them. It's simply a matter of when it happens. So they know they're going to get punished. They know about the lake of fire. They know about the bottomless pit. And they simply ask Jesus Christ, have you come here to torment us before the time? Now, a good way off from them, there was a herd of many swine feeding. So this was not in Israel. This was over in east of the Sea of Galilee in a Gentile area. So the demons ask him, if you cast us out, permit us to go away into the herd of swine. And he said to them, go. And when they had gone out, they went into the herd of swine. And suddenly the whole herd of swine ran violently down the steep place into the sea and perished in the water. So apparently Jesus Christ didn't feel it was an economic loss because they weren't intended to be eaten anyway. But these went into the water, and certainly those pigs got wet, but did not change the nature of pig meat, did not change the nature of what God told us in Leviticus chapter 11. So this is kind of on cutting edge of ridiculous, but it is one of the scriptures that's occasionally used to justify eating unclean foods. Now let's go over to a couple more. Mark chapter 7. Let's go to Mark chapter 7. This is the verse in the Bible where if you have a modern paraphrase, about half of the modern paraphrases simply add a statement that's not there because they want to justify eating unclean foods. So it's important if you have, and I looked up, I think it was the New American Standard, was the one I could find on my ESOR program this morning that had this extra phrase added in that is simply not in the Greek. Mark chapter 7, let's begin in verse 2. When they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is to say with unwashed hands, they found fault. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding the tradition of the elders. Now, some of the commentaries give us a pretty good idea of what this was all about, and it's come down to us today in some Jewish factions. But they would have to wash, I think it was 12 times, and they would have to air dry their hands, so they had to wash in their water, and they had to hold their hands up in the air until they were air dried. They couldn't contaminate them with what might be on a towel. And then they would be able to eat, and they had their sleeves rolled up, and they would make sure then that, well, there was no dirt whatsoever. But notice verse 4, when they come from the marketplace. Now, what happened in the marketplace? They brushed into Gentiles. Other people were in the markets. They crowded around the tables to buy fruit or meat, whatever they were buying. And so they felt their hands then were ceremonially defiled because they had come in contact with defiled people. And so to wash that off, they had to wash their hands and hold them up in the air and air dry them. It says there are many other things which they have received and hold. There are many other traditions that these Pharisaical Jews received from their elders, their teachers, and they hold. In other words, they hold fast to these teachings, like the washing of cups and pitchers and copper vessels and couches. So they would wash furniture and wash their cups in special ways and probably hang them dry, and who knows what they did with them. I don't think we have all the records of that. But to them, that was very important. Then the Pharisees and scribes ask him, "Why do your disciples not walk or act according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands? And why don't they follow all these rabbinical traditions?" And he answered and said to them, "Well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites? As it is written, the people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." He didn't want them necessarily to be preventing unclean dirt from coming in as much as he was unclean things into their heart. He was concerned more about a clean heart than a clean dish. "In vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." So they thought that was worshiping God, to wash their hands and hold them up in the air, and to wash their cups and saucers in certain ways. It's vanity. It's not worshiping God. It's following the doctrines of men. It is so easy to replace the teachings of God with the teachings of men. It's something we must always be on watch for. "For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men, the washing of pitchers and cups, and many other such things as you do." He said to them, "All too well, you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your tradition." Now, the commandment of God was not to eat unclean food, and to learn from that they were a special people, a holy people, and they should reject unclean ideas, thoughts, and temptations from their mind and their life. But instead, they allowed those other thoughts, the evil thoughts, while they washed their cups and their plates. Verse 10, "Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death." Interesting that this is one of the first signs of a holy people in Leviticus 19. He said, you must honor your father and mother. "But you say, if a man says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is korban, or is in a trust or in a set-aside account, so to speak, for the temple, then no longer do you let him do anything for his father and mother." So their parents were not being provided for because they had said, well, this is set aside money or set aside assets that keep me from having to take care of my parents. It says, "making the word of God of no effect through your own tradition." And people still do this. This is human nature, trying to get out of obeying God by doing various physical things and coming up with excuses. "When he called the multitude to himself, he said to them, hear me, everyone, and understand. There is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him." He's talking about dirt that might be on their hands or some little thing. "The things which come out of him, these are the things that defile him." So words, poor attitudes, lies, other things. "If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear." So if you have ears to hear what he's having to say, Jesus Christ said, understand what I'm saying. That what enters you from the outside going into your mind is what can defile you, not those things that might be on your food. Now, he's talking to a crowd, obviously, of Jews who did not eat unclean foods. There were no unclean foods there, so he's not addressing even that subject. "When he entered into a house away from the crowd, his disciples asked him concerning the parable. He said to them, are you thus without understanding also? Don't you perceive that whatever enters a man from outside cannot defile him?" Meaning that The attitudes of the heart and the spiritual aspects were the result of evil spiritual aspects, sins, and temptation that they fell for. Notice he says, because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach. He's talking about the heart being polluted, the heart being defiled. And is eliminated, thus purifying all foods. In other words, as it passes through your digestive system, food is cleaned, or at least the good things are taken up by your body, and the rest is removed. And this is the verse where they add, thus making all foods clean. And of course, it's not in the original Greek. It's not what he meant at all. This has nothing to do with unclean foods. But some of the translators in the modern day paraphrases insert that in there because it's what they want to have in there. It's not what he said. Verse 19 simply means making the food that goes through you is clean by your digestive system. He's not even talking about unclean meats. He said, what comes out of a man, that defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, lewdness, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these evils come from within and defile a man. He wanted to emphasize to them it was what came from within them that defiled them that they had to be concerned about. So once again, the subject here really is not unclean foods. The subject is spiritual pollution that might enter into a person's mind and then become part of their character and come out in the things that they say and do. Now, the one place in the Bible, in the New Testament anyway, that does address the subject of something being clean, unclean, is Acts chapter 10. And of course, you've probably gone through this many times, but in this case, they have this sheet of animals, of all kinds of animals that were unclean, that Peter saw in a vision, because God wanted him to understand that Gentiles were now going to be called by God. When Jesus Christ originally came, his ministry primarily centered on Judea and Samaria, Jerusalem. He sent the 12 apostles out only to the tribes of Israel, the scattered 12 tribes. But now it was time to expand the giving of God's Holy Spirit and the calling of God to be in his kingdom to all other nations. So this was a few years after the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. So it begins in chapter 10 with a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius. He was of the Italian regiment that was stationed there. He had a vision about going down to calling for Peter or Simon and where he was staying. Down in verse 9, the next day as they went on their journey and drew near the city, Peter went up to the housetop to pray about noon or the sixth hour. So Peter's going up on the housetop where he can be alone to pray about noon. He became very hungry and wanted to eat. While they made ready, he fell into a trance, so he has this vision. He saw heaven opened and an object like a great sheet bound at the four corners descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. My guess is it was a mixture of clean and unclean. A voice came to him saying, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." Peter said, "Not so, Lord." Now, of course, Peter and Jesus Christ had lived together virtually for 3 years, so Peter was very familiar with Jesus Christ's eating habits, and they had not eaten anything unclean. He says, "I have never eaten anything common or unclean." Now, there are two words here. It's important we understand the two words. The common means common as a Gentile, a non-Israelite, something ceremonially not approved by God. Unclean simply means unfit to eat. Very important because as we go down here, later he will say, "I have understood that God told me not to call any man common." He does not say anything about changing the nature of meats to clean from unclean. A voice spoke to him the second time, saying, "What God has cleansed, you must not call common." Notice the word common, meaning ceremonially not part of Israel, common, separate from those called into the special family of God or the special nation of God. So Peter said, "I haven't eaten anything common or unclean, but what God has cleansed," the angel said, "you are not to call common." Showing that God was now saying that people were to be cleansed, in other words, forgiven of their sins because of Jesus Christ's sacrifice, and they were now part of the family of Israel, spiritual Israel, part of that special called out priesthood and nation that God is now building. Verse 16, this was done three times. It's kind of amazing how often in Peter's life the number three comes up. Three times he denied Christ, three times he was restored, three times when he came back from fishing. The number three in Peter's life seems to be repeated over and over. I don't know why, it's just an observation, but it seems like God had to tell him, or Jesus Christ had to tell him two or three times before he eventually understood and got it clear in his mind. Notice Peter was wondering within himself what this vision meant, which he had seen. So he didn't jump up and say, let's go have some crabs. He said, I wonder what this vision means. God said not to call somebody common, not to call something common that I have cleansed. So while Peter wondered about this vision, behold, the men who had been sent from Cornelius made inquiry in Simon's house and stood there before the gate. So notice, there are three men. So the sheet was let down three times. Now there are three men. Verse 19, Peter thought about the vision. The spirit or the angel said to him, or God said through him, behold, three men are seeking you. He started thinking, okay, God said, don't call something common that I have cleansed or made clean. It happened three times. Now there are three men down here. Arise, therefore, go down and go with them, doubting nothing, for I have sent them. And, of course, the story was that Cornelius had seen the vision. He sent these three men, and Peter went with them on the road down to Joppa. And, of course, back, the Roman, the Caesarian, this is the centurion, was baptized and all of his family. And he mentions here, verse 34, Peter opened his mouth and said, the truth I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him. So he's talking about people not being common, not animals being unclean. But some of the commentaries will somehow use this chapter as an excuse for saying that somehow the nature of animals has been changed and people can now eat foods that God said should not be clean, should not be eaten. But in every nation, whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him. So he's talking about every nation and all peoples, not just those that were not part of physical Israel. There are several others, but the important thing here, of course, is understanding that we should put out things out of our life that are unclean. We are besieged by uncleanness every day, by attitudes of selfishness, of greed, of lust, of desire for physical things, avarice. And we have to make sure we are not allowing unclean temptation or thoughts into our mind, even as we don't allow unclean food into our mouth. I want to go over now to Romans chapter 14. In this case, vegetarianism is the subject, but some again use this chapter to try to justify or try to change God's clear teaching on unclean and clean foods. There are some good principles here, though, in Romans chapter 14. The principles that come out of this discussion we still apply today because we want to make sure that as those who are weak in the faith, those who are new, are making contact with us, that we are not offensive and that we are doing things wise, being wise as serpents but harmless as doves, understanding that we represent Jesus Christ in all that we say and do. Chapter 14 and verse 1, receive one who is weak in the faith. That's the subject of the chapter, is person who is brand new, who is weak in the faith, but not the disputes over doubtful things. Now, how many of you years ago came to church, perhaps only with a shallow understanding, and someone took you aside and dumped everything the church teaches on you at once? Told you all about unclean foods, about first, second, and third tithe, about going to all the feast days, and about you can't keep Christmas, you can't vote. I mean, all these things that people used to dump on. I don't want to see a show of hands. I've known a few people who came to church just having heard about the Sabbath, and then somebody at church just told them everything. I'm not sure if they came back, or I think most of them seemed to survive. But we want to be careful we don't do that. Paul is talking about not doing that to someone who is new in the faith, that we need to be careful, need to be circumspect, and praying to God for wisdom in all that we say and do. Notice, for one believes he may eat all things. This is again talking about somebody who's weak in the faith, but he who is weak eats only vegetables. And there were many in the Greek areas that were vegetarian, but they did not believe or did not practice eating any animal protein. We still have that with us today. The vegan movement has been around for a long, long time. But let not him who eats despise him who does not eat well. And let not him who does not eat judge him who does eat, for God has received him. So whether or not you eat meat or don't eat meat, God typically doesn't care that much about. What he does care about, of course, is not eating animals that he said we should not. Who are you to judge another servant? To his own master he stands or falls. Indeed, he will be made to stand, for God is able to make him stand. In other words, God will lead people who are new in the faith towards a stronger footing in the faith. One day esteems one day above another. Another esteems every day alike. And people back then would sometimes dedicate one day for fasting for a certain purpose. We still do that. We used to have church-wide fasts on a regular basis, still have some once in a while. But people would dedicate one day for whatever purpose, and then they would decide to serve God in a certain way on that day. And as long as it doesn't violate a commandment, apparently it's okay by God. He doesn't say anything about it. So a person might esteem a day. Eventually, the Roman Empire, just like it has today with the Catholic Church, every day is some saint's day or some special day. There's no day that doesn't have a special label for it. But he simply says, let each be fully convinced in his own mind. Don't worry about this setting aside of a certain day for prayer or fasting on a certain subject. Just don't worry about it. It is not a spiritual battle to fight. He who observes the day observes it to the Lord, and he who does not observe the day to the Lord, he does not observe it. This is not a day that's a holy day that God has set aside. This is a day a person esteems, not one that God sets aside. He who eats to the Lord, for he who gives God thanks, and he who does not eat, to the Lord he does not eat and gives God thanks. So a person can eat meat and be thankful to God, and a person can eat meat and be thankful to God. None of us lives to himself, and no one dies to himself. For if we live to the Lord. If we die to the Lord. Therefore, whether we live or die, we are the Lord's. So we have this very important principle. Verse 13 sort of sums up what the chapter is about. Therefore, let us not judge one another anymore. He's talking about the subject of vegetarianism. But rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or cause to fall in our brother's way. And there have been a few, not many, but a few vegetarians as members of God's church. And when I was at college years ago, we had a young man from Hawaii there who had been a vegetarian all of his life. He had never eaten any meat. And he tried a few times when he came in the church, and his body simply couldn't handle it. It made him violently sick. But I remember him sitting in the dining hall in Big Sandy with a massive plate of beans and a massive plate of peas and a massive plate of salad. And I wondered, how can anybody eat that much food? But, of course, I haven't been to the Slocums to see their three boys eat in recent days. But I do remember raising a son and some others. But at any rate, they had to eat a huge amount just to try to get the same protein because it is concentrated form in the physical meat. But nobody said anything. It was a choice. Nobody cared. Nobody criticized. Nobody went over and convinced him to try hamburger. They just said, fine, that's his choice. And I think we did a good job in those days of following the Apostle Paul's directives here. Now let's go over to 1 Corinthians 10, another subject that comes up in a verse that, or in a chapter that has nothing to do with clean and unclean meats, but is still sometimes used to talk about that subject. First Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 27. Let's start in verse 25. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market, asking no questions for conscience' sake. The subject here is the meat that was hanging in the meat market. If you've been to the Middle East or other parts of the world, it's not unusual to find half beef or half goats or big chunks of meat hanging from strings or sitting on tables. When we go to the store, we have it. It's all packaged. You know, we have our steaks all cut uniformly, and they're in a little tray of styrofoam, and then there's a cellophane over the top, and, you know, all the chickens are packaged in nice little packages, and all the legs and quarters look just alike. Kind of reminds you of this letter that was sent in to the NRA a number of years ago. They published in their NRA magazine, and I used to keep a copy of it. I think I lost it years ago, but letters, you know, dear editor, you know, why don't you hunters go to the store and buy your meat so that no innocent animals have to die just so you can eat. So the person who wrote it apparently thought that at the store, that meat just happened to arrive. It wasn't from animals in some way. So kind of like the lady that, and that is so funny, it's still on YouTube, that called in the radio talk show and said, why did they put that deer crossing sign there? The deer are always getting killed. Why don't you move the sign so no more deer will get hit? I mean, why would they put the machine? It's the most hilarious thing. My son listens to it. He rolls on the floor laughing. But sometimes logic doesn't enter into some of these conversations. But the important thing here is this. There were animals that were sold in the meat market, just hanging chunks of meat, and people would buy them. And they came from these pagan temples. People would give a little offering, oftentimes to one of these many, many, many temples that lined the streets, and they would take in their sheep or their goat or their pigeon or whatever, and they would then give it to them. The pagan priestesses or priests would sacrifice the animal, would bleed it to death, and then they would sell it in the meat market. So Paul says, when you go to the meat market, don't go around asking, was this from a pagan idol? Because it doesn't matter. The idol is nothing. And from this chapter, we understand very plainly that the idol is nothing. If we were in a room full of all sorts of statues and icons and all sorts of things that we would symbolize worshiping idols, it wouldn't matter because we know that it's just fantasy. There's no more realism to them than to Harry Potter or Peter Pan. It's just all make-believe. But it is obviously could be offensive, so we try to avoid those things. But simply here, verse 19, he says, the idol is nothing. And so whatever is offered to the idols is nothing. But drop down a little bit farther. He says, eat what is sold in the meat market, for the earth is the Lord's in all its fullness. And then in verse 27, he changes subject a little bit. If any of those who do not believe invite you to dinner. Okay, the subject here is people who are not in the church, who invite you to dinner, and you desire to go, eat whatever is set before you, asking no question for conscience sake. The subject is not unclean foods. The subject is, was it or was it not sold in the meat market and perhaps came from a pagan temple, pagan idol of some kind. He says, don't be Sherlock Holmes and ask them, what is the source of this meat? If it's simply clean meat to eat, then let's eat it. But if anyone says to you, this was offered to idols. In other words, if the host who's serving it to you makes a religious issue out of it. Say, by eating this, we are honoring whatever idol it might be. Or I want you to know this was offered to idols, and therefore you are taking something that has been tainted or that has been somehow polluted. He said, do not eat it. If the host makes a religious issue out of it, that it was offered to idols, then simply refuse it. Because the important thing is conscience's sake. For the sake of the one who told you and for conscience's sake, we are to completely shun anything to do with idolatry. He says, for the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Conscience, I say, not to your own, but that of the other. For why is my liberty judged by another man's conscience? Verse 31, of course, whatever you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And if they make a point out of worshiping an idol by eating this meat, that's not to the glory of God. But also give no offense either to the Jews or to the Greeks or to the church of God. So if eating it, everybody knowing it was offered to an idol would cause offense, we certainly wouldn't do that. So we don't participate in pagan service. We don't have any way of honoring those things allowed in our life. But the important thing is that we learn to say no to uncleanness in all forms. Let's go over to Isaiah chapter 66. I very much appreciate the last 10 chapters of Isaiah. Isaiah 55 through 66, I guess that'd be 11 chapters. Try to read them every year before the Feast of Tabernacles because it says so much about the conditions of the earth before the millennium and during the millennium and the wonderful restoration that's going to take place and the great peace. Isaiah chapter 66 is telling us somewhat about conditions before Jesus Christ returns because verse 22 talks about the new heavens and the new earth which are going to be made, that God is going to make and remain before him forever. In the last couple of verses of the chapter about all flesh coming and worshiping before me, just like Zechariah 14. But in Isaiah 66, verse 15, it says, behold, the Lord will come with fire. Very beautiful prophecy about the return of Jesus Christ to purify and restore the earth. We read this verse and verses like it sometimes on the Day of Trumpets. And with chariots, like a whirlwind, it'll come very quickly. you will not delay to render his anger with fury and his rebuke with flames of fire. For by fire and by his sword the Lord will judge all flesh, and the slain of the Lord shall be many. We know from Joel chapter 2 and places in Zechariah, other verses, that that great battle at Jerusalem will result in a great number of dead, and they will then have their chance in the second resurrection. Notice those who sanctify themselves and purify themselves to go to the gardens. He's talking about people who seek a false religion during that time for safety. After an idol in the midst, eating swine's flesh and the abomination and the mouse. We don't typically eat a lot of mice here, but they do over in the Far East, China, Vietnam, places like that. But certainly swine's flesh and other abominations are consumed all over the world. It says, those who do that shall be consumed together, says the Lord. So by virtue of this prophecy, we know that all of these flesh, all of these unclean foods, are going to be consumed by the time before Jesus Christ returns. And of course, we want to try to avoid that as much as possible. And as we look at the labels and as we ask about things like lard in the pie crust and that type of thing, we learn lessons about not touching those things that are unclean spiritually and keeping our minds clean, keeping our hearts free from being polluted. Let's go over to 2 Corinthians chapter 6, where we have this summarized very well. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. We understand this chapter about being not unequally yoked together. But at the end of the chapter is a very interesting statement. In verse 16 of 2 Corinthians 6, it says, what agreement has the temple of God with idols? Of course, it says, you are the temple of the living God. Your body should be reflective of that. You should reflect the Spirit of God living within you. As God has said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Therefore, in other words, because God is walking in your life and God is walking among us, come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. And that's the spiritual lesson we learn by obeying God's laws of cleanness and uncleanness. Do not touch what is unclean. And sadly, we have too much touching of what is unclean in our lives. We need to be very, very careful that we clean that up and ask for God's help in obeying this very, very carefully. Do not touch what is unclean, and I will receive you. I will be a father to you, and you shall be my sons and my daughters, says the Lord God Almighty. God wants us to be his children. He wants to be a father to us. He wants us to be his sons and his daughters. And one way we learn to do that is by observing his laws of unclean meats.
You could take your